Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Femuliner. Ruben Stern's on vacation this week. It's been over a month since the Occupy Wall Street protests began. The roughly 2,000 people in New York got some media attention at first, but the national focus on the movement really catapulted when hundreds of so-called occupiers were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Similar protests have cropped up in cities and towns across the country, including here. Occupy Como is in front of Columbia City Hall. The larger movement has been a subject of analysis on numerous fronts. Occupiers have used the internet and social media to significantly enhance the demonstrations. Many have compared and contrasted the Occupy movement to the Arab Awakening overseas or even the Tea Party here in the U.S. And there's also criticism of the organization and articulation skills of the movement, which lacks a clear leader. That's by design, though. Some analysts describe the organization of the group as radically democratic. But how does this movement compare to other grassroots social movements? Today on Intersection, we hope to find out why some flourish and others fizzle out. And our guests all have different perspectives on these issues. This week, we're joined by Mark Higham. He's the director of Mid-Missouri Peace Works. He's lived in Columbia for 40 years now, and if you live in town, you've likely seen him before, whether you know it or not. He's the driving force behind the anti-war protest on Providence Road in Columbia, which has been happening for almost a decade now, and he's been active in a variety of peace, environment, and social justice issues over the years. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Good day. Good to be with you.
David Mitchell is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. As a lawyer, Mitchell has worked with marginalized populations throughout his career, so he has some insight into the conditions that lead groups to say enough is enough and actually mobilize. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, and finally, Spencer Verostek is one of the activists with Occupy Como. He lives in Columbia and has been a part of Occupy Como for a little more than a month now. He describes himself as someone that was politically aware before, but not really politically active until the Occupy protests started. This is his first experience as part of a social movement. And Spencer, thanks for leaving your post in front of City Hall today to join us in the studio.
It's my pleasure.
All right. And joining us by phone, too, is Gretchen Arnold. She's an assistant professor of sociology and women's studies at St. Louis University. She specializes in social movement theory and can help us take a wider perspective on what's happening in the U.S. right now. Gretchen, thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm happy to be here.
All right, great. And we hope to hear from you and our audience as well. Have you ever been to a protest? What motivated you to go? Share your thoughts. Call us at 573-882-8925 or email us at intersection@kbia.org. And I think it makes some sense right now to start with Spencer here, answering basically that question. What motivated you to go to this protest and really get involved with Occupy Como for the first time?
Well, It really kind of started out through various contacts I had had. I stumbled across on the internet some videos of what was going on Wall Street. And it really kind of struck a chord with me when I realized, you know, exactly what the clear message was. Because despite what a lot of the mainstream media was saying, it was obvious right there. They were talking about it plain as day. We're being manipulated by the upper 1% to an extent. And it was really just kind of something I could get behind, and seeing how they were being, their First Amendment rights were being suppressed, and they were just trying to be taken straight off the streets. I wanted to go to New York right then and there, but it's a really difficult thing to just leave your life behind. And from there, it was just a matter of finding out that it was going on where I lived, and that's where I could contribute.
Mm-hmm. And so social media, really, that's been a big common theme, is that this movement has really relied on social media to get its word out, and really for organization as well. And that seems like it's true with you.
I believe definitely at the very beginning, if it hadn't have been for social media, it wouldn't have spread across the nation and across the globe as fast as it had. 20, 30 years ago, a similar movement could have happened, and it would have been a about a week before people across the country had really heard anything about it. There might have been a blurb on the national news, but with social media like Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook, it just spread like wildfire within days.
And Mark, he mentioned 20 or 30 years ago, it may have been harder to get this out. Maybe you can help us with that. How does this compare now compared to how it may have been to spread something like this in a town like Columbia for something that is to get traction, I guess?
Well, you know, I think that movements have grown organically over time, maybe a faster or slower paces, and certainly contemporary movements, like all contemporary activities, businesses and whatnot, are using the internet and using social media. However, I think that the key ingredients in making a movement happen are still the same. The methods of communication might be different, but essentially you need to be doing the same sorts of work to cultivate and activate a base of people who share a common set of concerns, and then to figure out how to make that have some traction, how to keep it going over the long haul. And that's one of the big things that needs to be taken on by this movement or any movement, because what we found historically is that no movements achieve their results overnight. It takes years and even decades.
Mm-hmm. And how do you mobilize someone like Spencer here, who had never really taken that step to be politically active? I mean, I'm sure that's something that you've tried to do over the years. How do you get someone to join the ranks, if you will?
There's no one way to do it, but I think being inviting and being welcoming are critical for any movement group, and having a democratic process so that people don't feel like they're just, you know, there to be a warm body, but feel like they're included in decision-making, that really helps a lot. And I know that the Occupy movement has really pushed for a participatory democratic structure, perhaps even to a extreme level from some people's perspectives, but certainly that's helpful to get people invested. But bottom line is most people in this society don't have activism within their repertoire. And in order to get activism in their repertoire, there has to be some kind of a reinforcement to the process. When you get active, you see something that's positive that comes of it, so you stay active.
Right. And so, David, I saw you reacting to what he was saying there.
Sure. I mean, I think there are a couple of things, right? I mean, I think this contemporary movement is much different in terms of using the technology, and I agree with that, right? But I also think about the civil rights movement, right? The black churches was today's Twitter, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in effect, that was the method to which you would communicate, here's an issue, this is what we're doing. We are going to march in X place, we're going to sit in here, right? And so, in effect, that was today's, if you will, Twitter or email or internet. One of the things I would sort of look at this particular movement in a little bit different way is that I think it's easier for other movements that have a concrete or sort of a hardcore or identifiable sort of wrong that they're addressing, right? Mm-hmm. I think if you're looking at sort of civil rights, you're saying we are addressing the indignity that is being heaped upon a particular group, the immigrants movement, right? The anti-immigration movement now. Mm-hmm. It's a group of people that we're trying to address, the WTO movements, right? The war movements. This one, I think, is a little bit different in that you're talking about this broader-based, I think, movement that's cutting across a number of different sort of class groups, right? This is a movement that, in effect, reflects a very different type of individual who's going to be inspired. And I think that's the difficulty for some folks, about how do you be inspired, right? It's easy for me as an African-American to be inspired about civil rights when I can't go sit in the lunch counter, you know, when I can't do X, right? Sort of looking at this notion of addressing the economic issue, well, that's kind of difficult for some of us who live comfortably, right, saying that the 1% is controlling our lives and feeling guilty about our own comfort, and do we really belong in this sort of larger movement? And I think that's what the challenge is, I think, for the Occupy movements across the nation.
And I hate to interrupt that thought, no. But I do have to take a second to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today on the show, we're examining the Occupy Wall Street protests, which began more than a month ago. How did the movement emerge and how has it been sustained? And on a larger scale, we're talking about grassroots social movements and why some flourish while others fizzle out. Joining us in the studio are Mark Higham, the director of Mid-Missouri Peace Works, David Mitchell, an associate professor of law at MU, and Spencer Verostek, one of the activists with Occupy Como. Also joining us on the phone is Gretchen Arnold, an assistant professor of sociology and women's studies in St. Louis University. And for you and our audience, what do you make of the Occupy movement? Let us know what you think. Call 573-882-8925 or email at intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. And so, yeah, you were mentioning the things that are a challenge for the Occupy movement. The other things that have been brought up, of course, are the lack of leadership, and then, of course, just articulating what the group wants. I guess, Spencer, I'll give you a chance since you're part of that movement. I know that's a big task to try to answer as well. But what do you say to those criticisms of this movement?
Well, I can't speak for the group. I can only speak for myself. Mm-hmm. But we like to say around there that we're not a leaderless movement. We're all leaders, and we have to lead by example. You step forward and do something when you see it needs to be done. We like to call it a duocracy sometimes, where you can bring things up at the General Assembly that need to be addressed, and we can make work groups to try and address them. But in general, if you see a piece of trash lying on the ground, pick it up. If you see somebody who has some misinformation, step forward on the forums or on Facebook and put forward the information that might be able to influence them to change their mind about it.
So it requires a lot of cooperation, requires a lot of like-minded people.
Cooperation and individual initiative. You don't have to – one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to empower the community to be a community again. Many people are content to sit back and let the talking heads on TV do the thinking for them, and they watch the TV and they listen to the radio and they read the newspapers. And while that's certainly a way to educate yourself about it, there's other ways that you can get information, such as – talking to people. People will come by that have never stopped and never talked to us as individuals, come by Liberty Plaza and pass judgment on us right there and tell us to get a job. And, 75-80% of us have jobs. And of the 20%, the 20-25% that are left, most of them are looking for jobs. We're not all unemployed and hanging out and not taking showers. We have homes. We go and sleep in them. We go and shower. It's ignorance is probably our biggest enemy at this point.
Well, and Gretchen, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. Historically, in social movements, do they need a leader? Is that something that's essential for success, or is this an anomaly, or is there an example we can use to compare this to?
No, they don't have to have designated leaders. So leaders can change. They can change pretty quickly. The feminist movement in the 1970s and 80s in this country was a very good example of a leaderless movement. What you need is for a movement to be able to articulate a grievance that in some way that interprets it as unjust or immoral and give people a sense that they can actually change things. And then it also helps to have a target against which the movement is organizing. I mean, those are really some key pieces you need to get a social movement going. And so it seems to me that in terms of the Occupy Wall Street movement, that the grievances seem to be coalescing around the issues of economic inequality and a belief that wealthy corporations and individuals have too much control over our government. Now, this resonates with a lot of people who are experiencing economic insecurity today. There's also a widespread belief that the government's actions since the 2008 economic collapse have been primarily intended to benefit big business and finance rather than those average Americans who are hurting. And so I think that, one of the key things that's really helped this movement get going is the symbol of occupying Wall Street, which has been a very powerful one. You know, for a long time in this country, Wall Street has been a symbol of American business and finance. So it was easy for people to interpret the initial protests as having something to do with a general grievance against corporate and financial interests. And then the slogan, "We are the 99%, helped create a sense of collective identity, that is a sense of a group with a common interest. So it creates this idea of us against them, us, the 99%, against one, their 1%. And that's really what helps mobilize people. In terms of leadership, no, the leadership can be very fluid. It can change. We saw that in the New Left, the anti-war movement. There are people who can appear as spokespeople. And those can change as well. But leadership can be quite fluid.
Well, and David, yeah.
Well, I mean, I just wanted to jump in quickly. I mean, I agree with everything with what Gretchen just said. And she raised the issue of the feminist movement, right? And, you know, there were critiques of the feminist movement that it didn't cover women of color, right? And you talk about economic inequality. Well, black folks have been addressing economic inequality for quite some time. So have Hispanics, right? And so this movement may not resonate with that population that says, now everyone else is sort of concerned with economic inequality. Now, because we're in this economic crisis, now because it's addressing a larger proportion or the mainstream, now we're going to sort of stand up. And I think, and so when I say, you know, the challenges of bringing folks in, I think it faces some of the challenges of some of the other mainstream movements that have addressed problems, because there are folks who've said, we've long engaged with this issue, but now it's getting this sort of public media perception. And because I don't think, for some folks, you know, it doesn't have that clear sort of, well, what is it? Who are we going after? And what's the change we're seeking? That I think for some people, it's very difficult to sort of join on and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was easy for civil rights to say, look, we want to get voting rights laws. We want to get civil rights legislation passed for the suffragists. We want to get the voting amendment. I think this one, people can't really place it in a very sort of simple change for them to say, ah, that's why I'm out here, right? Or that's why I want to come out here.
Well, you said that the issue of economic inequality had been addressed numerous times before, but it hadn't been specifically addressed as its own movement. It had been part of other movements, and so it was, you were able to gain ground in those movements without necessarily solving the problem of economic inequality. Maybe you made it better a little bit or whatnot, and that's why I think it's probably now is the time in which we can come together, despite differences in other opinions on other issues, we can come together and go, well, yes, there is a very large difference between the ultra wealthy and everybody else.
That's true.
You know, one of the things that's been going on is that we are finally reaching a point where people are waking up to what's been going on for three decades now. Since the beginning of the Reagan administration, or maybe even back in the Carter administration, economic distribution is becoming more and more skewed. And we've seen the wages of the average working person flat or perhaps even declining if they're in lower wage groups. We've seen a lot of jobs exported overseas. We've seen the rich get richer and richer and richer, so that over the past decade or so, the people in the top tier have tripled their incomes, while others have hardly seen them grow. I shouldn't say the last decade, the last three decades, they've tripled their incomes in real terms, whereas people in other groups have not. They've had very small gains. So it's become a much more skewed distribution, and the economic crisis has brought this home to people. During the years of the bubble, a lot of people were living on borrowed money, their credit cards. A lot of people were using the increase in value of their homes, which was on paper, not in reality, unless they sold them, to finance the kinds of home equity loans that gave them money to live on because their jobs weren't paying them enough to meet their lifestyle. And now a lot of people have become unemployed or feel like they might become unemployed or underemployed. Jobs have been outsourced, gone overseas, and a lot more people are feeling economically insecure and troubled. And I think that's, a terrible thing we're going through, but it's a good thing people are waking up and starting to take action. So I think it's an encouraging sign, and I do think that Occupy Wall Street stands for something. I think it's been somewhat said it's very amorphous, but it's really about power relationships in our society. It's about the influence of the wealthy and the large corporations over the electoral process, over who's in office and what policies they support. What goes on when Congress is talking about cutting social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare when 80% of the people don't want those cut? What goes on when they're not raising the taxes, rolling back the Bush tax cuts on the most well-to-do? The most well-to-do can easily afford to pay at a higher tax rate. They did fine in the Clinton years, and we're in a situation where we have these big deficits. You don't want to take that money out of the hides of working people, but people who can afford it should. And in fact, more than two-thirds of the public agrees with that, but Congress won't act on it. So that's why you have an Occupy Wall Street.
Right. I'm going to take another moment here to remind our listeners that this is Intersection. I'm Ryan Famiglione. Reuben Stern is on vacation this week. It's been over a month since the Occupy Wall Street protests began. The roughly 2,000 people in New York got some media attention at first, but the national focus of the movement really catapulted when hundreds of so-called occupiers were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. Now we're going to take a moment here to go ahead and give you a chance to call in if you would like to give a chance. It's the number here is 882-8925, or you can email us at intersection@kbia.org. And we also have an online chat for you to join if you would like to do so. And getting to that, Mark, like we mentioned and we alluded to in the introduction, you've been a part of many protests, many movements, social movements over the years. How about that point of having one specific goal or one specific entity to rally against, or even just a goal, an option, I guess.
A clear option's great, you know. And during the Vietnam War, which was when I was first an activist, we wanted to end the war. But even then, you had people within the movement who didn't agree. Some people said, out now. Other people said, set the date, you know. And you've often had within movements people who come to different points of view about the same goals. Now, in this case, certainly it's not as clear as end the war, although I know Occupy has embraced the idea of ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, at least in some of their documents. I know that we have some differences between different Occupy groups around the country, but if you read through the Declaration of the Occupation of New York City, which is the seminal document, I think, or if you read through the 99% Declaration, both of these people can find online. You'll find that there are very many specific things the movement's calling for.
Right.
And I think that's a really good point, pointing out how different occupations are coming up with different sets of goals and different declarations, because each community is different. The people, you don't have the same people living in city to city. You have different sizes, different industries, different education systems. And I think it's that's why this movement kind of had to spring up all at once across the nation and across the globe, because each community is going to know how to fix the problems within it best. You can't have Washington, D.C. saying how small-town USA is going to fix, because Washington, D.C. is not small-town USA. Mm-hmm. Small-town USA has to kind of step forward and approach its city hall and say, you know, these are the problems we see in our day-to-day life, and this is how we think we can address them.
But what do you accomplish in small-town USA by having an Occupy Como? Occupy New York obviously gets a lot of attention, some media coverage. What do you accomplish in a small town, I guess?
Well, that's a very good point. It's not like we can, you know, make a whole big dent on the financial industry in front of City Hall in Columbia. We have a few banks, and most of the ones that are within visible range of City Hall are fairly responsible. I can't say for certain 100% because I haven't done an audit of each and every one of them, but you know, they're fairly responsible. But we can raise awareness. We can get people to call their senators. We can get people to participate in their government, which I think is a big thing. For too long, we've been sitting back and letting our government govern us. It's a government for the people, by the people, of the people. We're the people, folks. We got to step forward and do this.
And Mark, again, you've been here for a long time. Was there the temptation to go to a larger city? Or, again, what can you accomplish in a small town?
I think
the same question.
I'm a great believer in think globally, act locally. I think it is important, though, to articulate a national and even global agenda at the local level. So I don't necessarily think we should just focus on local circumstances. I think we need to look at the big picture. But part of what I see that you're alluding to here, Ryan, is the fact that the tactic of sitting in or occupying a location on an ongoing basis, particularly an outdoor location, is somewhat self-limiting in that the people who can do that on a regular basis aren't all the people who would like to participate. And a lot of people have situations where they either have families, they have jobs, they have kids to take care of, they have school to go to, and they can drop in occasionally. But as the weather gets colder, fewer and fewer people are going to be able to stay out for long periods of time. So you have a real situation where a movement like this needs to grow and embrace tactics that are workable. I've talked to people there who say they're going to be there 24/7 throughout the for the foreseeable, and I commend and think it's great that people have that kind of stick-to-itiveness, but I think that what's really needed is to do things like to set a time when a lot of people can come together around a specific action. I know there's plans for one of those coming up this Saturday from noon to 1 at City Hall, and I'd encourage people who are interested to come out for that. I'd also like to see a march on Bank of America here in town. That would make a lot of sense. Because
there was a discussion on doing a march on Bank of America during that rally, but the point was brought up that because we want people to show up, we had it held on a Saturday at noon, and banks close at noon on Saturday, so almost, you know, we'd be yelling at an empty building.
Maybe there's a need to do it on a different day after this November 5th. But the point I'm trying to make is that people need to figure out how they can involve lots of people, parents with young kids and senior citizens. Retirees actually have made a significant impact at this local Como occupation because they have the time to come out. And I've seen a number of people who are, you know, even older than me, who've been out there and been there pretty consistently, and that's great. But you have to be inclusive.
And we actually have a caller we're going to try to get in here. We have about 3 minutes before the break. His name's Michael. He's calling. He said he had a comment about representation. Michael, are you there?
Yes, sir.
All right. What would you like to contribute here, Michael?
Well, I would like to thank you all for airing this program. I think it's a great topic. I'm getting some feedback on it. Like, it's hard for me to talk. Basically, we have a representative democracy with no representation. You can vote for a Democrat or Republic, and neither one of them are going to represent the average person's views.
You're here.
You agree?
Definitely.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I do research on, you know, on
felons
who are disenfranchised, right? I mean, here are populations of individuals who actually can't participate. And I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, I support this movement, 100%. I mean, I don't think the goal and the concept is incredibly important, but I find some of the things very difficult, right? Yeah, I agree that there are local communities, have their local politics and those issues, but the overwhelming or the underlying theme of the movement is addressing big government as it is positioned in D.C. or Wall Street in New York, right? The folks who are there, the moneylenders, setting policy in one place, affecting us all. And I get that. And so for me, the question becomes, sitting in at City Hall in Columbia, Missouri, how is that fundamentally impacting those individuals, right? How are we fundamentally changing that mindset, those policies from where we are? Now, I get we want to increase activism. We want to get participation. And those things are all laudable. But the problem becomes, how do you translate a laudable activity of speaking up into productive activity to get things done when, in effect, what you just said, there are people who have circumstances where they can't come out to protest, where they can't be actively involved, right? Well, there's long been programs to write your senators, to call your senators in. Effective?
Yeah, debatable, yes.
Indeed. Right? I mean, so, and then you talk about the population of folks who are disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. Well, they have no voice already,
right?
And you're excluding all these folks. And so, in effect, for me, the question becomes, how do you make this such that it's a movement that says, listen, not only are we out here raising our voices, but we're actually getting something done, right? And the last thing is about the sort of the duocracy. Who's accountable? I mean, I've long been a part of, you know, groups that are consensus-based, right? And I always find that consensus-based groups, you're sort of like, okay, let's sort of sit down and get something done. All righty, well, we have a deadline. Nothing happened by the deadline. Who's accountable? Well, nobody. We all are. And you're sort of like, okay, well, great. It's great to have that collective sort of identity. And yet, at the end of the day, somebody needs to be writing the check, right? Somebody needs to be the one who says, okay, you screwed up. This didn't work. We got to either change something, right? Now, doesn't mean you have to have a specific model of leadership, but at least something, I think, that people can say, oh, that person, I am, you know, on board with that principle. I'm on board with what they're doing.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to have to interrupt you guys because we're going to have to take a quick break. I'll be back here in just a few moments. I want to thank Michael for calling in and remind our listeners that Intersection is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today on the show, we're examining grassroots social movements and why some flourish while others fizzle out. Joining us in the studio are Mark Higham, the director of Mid-Missouri Peace Works, David Mitchell, an associate professor of law at MU, and Spencer Verostek, who's one of the activists with Occupy Como, joining us from his spot here today. Also joining us by phone is Gretchen Arnold, an associate professor of sociology and women's studies at St. Louis University. We'll be back right here after a short break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, filling in for Reuben Stern, who's on vacation. Today on the show, we're examining grassroots social movements and why some flourish and others fizzle out. Joining us in the studio are Mark Heim, the director of Mid-Missouri Peace Works, David Mitchell, an associate professor of law at MU, and Spencer Verostek, one of the activists with Occupy Como. Also joining us by phone is Gretchen Arnold, an assistant professor of sociology and women's studies at St. Louis University. For you and our audience, what do you think needs to be done to sustain a social movement? Share your thoughts. Call us at 573-882-8925, email us at intersection@kbia.org, or join our online chat. And I'm going to go back to Dr. Arnold. We haven't had you in for a moment. These guys keep jumping back and forth. It's hard when you're not here with us to jump in. But I just wanted to see what you wanted to weigh in on in relation to we talked a little bit about some other social things that are going on nationwide. And there's been some comparisons to this of the Occupy movement to the Tea Party movement or to the American Arab Spring, they're calling it the American Arab Spring. Not that that exists, but what's your take on that? It's been kind of a loose comparison, and there's been some kickback, I would say, on that comparison as well.
Right. Well, it's still really early to make these comparisons, but in terms of comparison with the Tea Party, it's clear that there are differences in terms of the general analysis of what the problem is that needs to be addressed. You know, for the Tea Party, they essentially see the government as the problem, and so their task, as they see it, is to roll government back. Occupy Wall Street, on the other hand, sees the concentration of wealth and power as the problem. And for some of them, at least, I think, government can be part of the solution. But, of course, their argument is the government needs to be more democratic in order for that to happen. In terms of the Arab Spring, you know, on the one hand, we're in a very different political context. I mean, in Arab countries, they're not democratic countries, they're not responsive, and so it's hard to make that comparison. But I will point out that there, I saw recently an interesting video on the internet that a sympathizer of Occupy Wall Street had made showing clips of Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama talking about how there needs to be the opportunity for free protest and people need to have a voice in their government and so on. And these comments were made, of course, in response to the crackdown by Arab governments on protests in their countries. And then the video would intersperse to clips of crackdowns on protests here in the United States. You know, crackdowns on the Wall Street protests and how violent they had become. And largely, it appears to be police-initiated violence as well. So, you know, any time that there is a violent crackdown by the police, well, not any time, but what it can tend to do, and what I think it has done in this case, is that it helps mobilize people to get out and to actually support the movement. So it has a kind of backlash result.
Right, right. And, I mean, I guess there's a couple different things we can talk about when it comes to comparing these movements. I mean, there's the ideologies, which I've seen some comparisons to the Tea Party is an easy one. Here in the U.S., it's a little harder to make those types of connections, or at least try to anyway. But then there's also just the organization, I guess, and the fact that it's a modern movement.
But the Tea Party is far more hierarchical. It's funded by rich and powerful mm-hmm. people who have an agenda, and they've used it for electoral purposes to elect very right-wing Republicans.
In the beginning, it wasn't quite so.
No, that's true, but I think pretty much right from the start. And I know there are people in the Democratic Party who would like to co-opt Occupy Wall Street if they can and help re-elect Obama in 2012. I think that it's important for this movement, though, to make it clear what its agenda is, because when you look at the two parties that we face, there's differences between them, but both of them have largely gotten in bed with the richest and most powerful interests in our society. And, you know, while I personally have a preference for one over the other, I also see the need for a movement that articulates goals that go way beyond what the Obama administration has embraced. And it's important for those goals to be articulated and move forward by a movement that maintains its independence from the Democratic Party, in my opinion.
Well, and there I read an article that was asking whether the Occupy movement is going to matter, whether it matters yet. And it said that one measurement of why the Tea Party mattered is because it did affect those elections. Is that one of the measurements that should be taken here, or what should we look at to determine whether Occupy matters long term?
Ryan, yeah. Can I jump in here?
Yes, of course.
What I would say is that I think Occupy Wall Street has been very effective so far in influencing political discourse in this country. I mean, you know, for the last 1.5 or 2 years, all the talk about what government needs to do has been about budget cutting, decreasing the deficit, rolling back government. And what the Occupy Wall Street protesters have done, I think, is to really shift the focus of political discourse so that there is a lot more talk now about inequality and the concentration of wealth and power. And if that continues to go on up until the next election, then I think it is going to have an impact on the election just by changing the terms of what it is people are concerned about.
David, I saw you react to that.
It's probably because I'm just a born pessimist, I think. I hope it would have an impact, I'm not all that certain that it will have an impact, because I think at the end of the day, you still operate within the existing institutional structure, right? That you can bring in issues and identify flaws, and yet the institutional structure of how Congress relates to the president, of how they interact with big business, of how big business says, we need you to support us so that we don't have a failing economy, so that more people aren't unemployed, those relationships still maintain. Now, if there's a platform of candidates from Occupy Wall Street, maybe that's a little bit different, right? Like the Tea Party platform of candidates, they actually changed the tenor of the discussion. Well, I would disagree slightly. I think if there are individuals who represent this movement's goals and ideals and those individuals gain some power, then yes, it's going to have an impact, a lasting impact. Yeah. I'm not all that, unfortunately, optimistic that it will.
In a sense, the idea that we could choose a candidate that speaks for us and put them forth as a possibility for an elected office goes contrary to some of the things that Occupy is talking about. We believe in a direct democracy, and choosing someone to represent us kind of runs counterintuitive to that.
Right, but in order to have a direct democracy, you got to get rid of the Electoral College. I mean,
what I'm saying is that
this is not a direct democracy, and, mm-hmm. and I think we sort of kid ourselves by thinking that it is. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not one person, one vote. As a matter of fact, some folks don't even have a vote, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this is about, in effect, how do you mold or shape the institutions to what you want to put forward? And the fact is that we don't exert enough leverage in actually to sort of address some of those concerns, right? I mean, I have no problem with saying the bankers, the moneylenders, all these individuals need to change how they are engaging in business, that folks who lost their homes because of foreclosure should not have lost their homes while we sent money to individuals to big bailouts, right? Mm-hmm. I agree wholeheartedly with that. Mm-hmm. The problem is that structure hasn't been toppled, right? Now I'm speaking like the big revolutionist. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been toppled. That hasn't been changed or upset. The problem is you're still in that structural system.
The problem is you and I pay attention to what's going on, and us here pay attention. A lot of people are too busy watching Jersey Shore. they're too busy participating in things other than their government. And when we sit here and talk about it in words that let's face it, a portion of the population are going to ignore, not because they don't know the words, but because they don't want to have to remember what they mean because it's not in their everyday lexicon. It kind of takes us out of the – my point being is that by encouraging and speaking plain sense to people instead of nonsense to them, we can get participation, and then we'll have the leverage to do the things we feel maybe we need to do.
Well, that's all good, and I'm all for that. I think, though, it's really important to recognize – that this notion that it's all about direct democracy or participatory democracy, I think, misses some of it, because I know that within the Occupy Wall Street movement, there are people who recognize a need for some kind of electoral structure, some kind of representative structure, and there is something that's called the 99% Declaration. This has come out of Occupy Wall Street directly in New York, and it's being circulated throughout the movement right now. And what they're calling for is a national convention in Philadelphia on July 4th of 2012. And they're calling for each congressional district in the country to send two representatives, a man and a woman, to participate in hammering out a platform that then will be presented to all the candidates and ask them to enact this by July 4th, 2013, whoever wins the elections. Now, I'm not sure this is the best strategy to pursue, but it's certainly a strategy that's being looked at and looked at by people throughout the country right now. And I think you're going to see things like this moved forward. Where it goes to, it's too early to predict. I agree with Gretchen. But on the other hand, I don't think it's all about direct democracy or consensus decision-making at the local grassroots level. I think a lot of it's recognizing that these are national issues and national global issues in some cases and will need to be addressed by the national level of our country and our government.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take another second. We have a call. Miguel is on the line. He actually said he had a question for you, Mark. Miguel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Miguel, thanks for joining us.
Okay. Oh, well, first of all, thanks to everybody for being part of this program, and thanks to KBIA. My question, I just actually go to everybody there, and I really thanks everybody for the good job they're doing, especially Spencer and Mark in Columbia and the other professors. And what I'm trying to do is, I'm part of the occupation too, but I have some reasons I can't do health problems. What I'm seeing for the years of being in Colombia, and this is my first time that I'm kind of trying to become an advocate for the community at some points. And when I hear the occupation I'm there, and most of the time people come over there, you know what's going on. And I'm very happy to see me standing there sometimes and expressing my theoretical, you know, freedom and see how I feel, and because I have a son too. He's very soon going to be in college, and I'll be somewhere around. And I learned a lot of stuff about politics when I was very, very young. And now, for me, this movement started in New York. I think this is a good time for this country, and a good time for young people to start not only being so active, but to be more careful on their future, the country or the world, because the world at this moment is a place where it's kind of always been like this, but it looks like this time is very chaotic, you know. And I'm very curious now, really, about being part of not only the Colombia, part of the country, part of the world. I'm immigrant. But when I came to Colombia, I remember many, many years ago, I didn't have an idea what I was getting in, you know, the city and everything. And today I feel, you know, I'm very proud to be here in Colombia, nice city and different type of people. My whole thing about is peace. I want people to try to make the point across and try to say whatever they can say, but keep it in, well, no violence.
Sure, sure.
That's my really concern about violence throughout the situation in some areas of the country with, you know, with the police, like in Oakland, California.
Right, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, and that's an important point. As Gretchen mentioned, those anytime police are getting involved, this is creating a lot more awareness for this movement. And
sure, and it has been a nonviolent movement, overwhelmingly so, and the ideals that are being put forth are for nonviolent action. Mm-hmm. I know Occupy Como adopted a statement of direction that included the embrace of nonviolence, mm-hmm. and I think that's really important. Now, obviously, you can't control what the police will do, but hopefully our elected officials will recognize that this is a nonviolent movement and exercise some restraint in what they do have the police go in and do. And what we saw out in Oakland and Denver and some other places where people were injured and people sent to the hospitals, that really is unacceptable, and people need to speak out against that.
And Miguel, thank you for that call. The other thing he mentioned that gets back to that idea of the comparison to the Arab Spring is that it's young people that are doing this for the most part, and that was the case overseas as well. Why that demographic, I guess, this time?
Well, I'd like to jump in and say, yeah, it started with a lot of young people, and those were some of the people who came over at the very beginning because they're in a state where they're learning about the world and they're more receptive to new ideas. But some of our staunchest supporters and the ones who've been sitting out there the most and being most visible during working hours have been retired people. They've stepped forward and said, we believe in what you're saying, and we agree with you, and we want to get our voice heard, too.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go, Gretchen, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, students sometimes have a little bit more discretionary time. But also students have a lot at stake in this. You know, people have tried to discredit these protesters by dismissing them as a bunch of people who are unemployed, they're students, they're homeless. But if you think about it, these are groups who have a lot at stake in the current economic recession. So it's no surprise that they're drawn to these protests. And I also think we need to be careful, these kinds of criticisms that people make, we need to be careful about implying that people who lose their jobs or people who are homeless, that they're no longer allowed to have a legitimate voice in our politics. I mean, really, since when does the franchise depend on one's job or where one lives? But I also agree with the comment made before, is that it does appear that Occupy Wall Street's support is broader in the population than just these groups. It appears to have at least, a certain amount of support from a variety of people of different ages, classes, races, and other kinds of social locations.
Yeah, I mean, I was just gonna add, and I agree with that. I think the retirees, the students, I think you may miss that sort of middle-aged, middle-class category is because of this issue of comfort level, right? Is because of this issue of, yes, I know it's impacting me in a very real way, and yet there is maybe for some a sense of, do I really fit into this movement? Right? Am I really a genuine and sincere participant given my class status? I mean, for me, I mean that's an issue that I would certainly raise. I'm a university professor.
Well, I won't judge you by your job if you don't judge me by mine.
Thank you. And hopefully, more folks probably judge me by the fact that I'm a lawyer. You know, that's the biggest problem. But I think that's the issue. I mean, I look at our students who are graduating with $120,000 worth of debt and can't get a job. Right? Mm-hmm. Yes, these are clearly going to be the folks who are going to occupy and say, wait a minute,
yeah.
We are the ones who are being forgotten in this economic mess, mm-hmm. right? And the people, and I love what Gretchen said about, you know, being homeless or being unemployed
houseless.
Does not mean, in effect, houseless. Mm-hmm. Does not mean that, in effect, you no longer have a valid voice, mm-hmm. right? And I think that is incredibly important, which is often sort of overlooked here, mm-hmm. that you still have a stake in how, the outcome of this sort of debate is going to be.
A big stake. Big stake.
Also along those same lines, and this one is a personal view of mine that's a little bit more on a touchy subject, but is felons. Why is it that when you commit a felony, people make mistakes, and if you have served, and I'm not saying that prisoners need to be allowed to vote, but if you've served your time and repaid your debt to society, why is your voice taken away still?
Well, you just said, and you don't think prisoners. I mean,
I was going to say you mistakenly stepped into David's expertise.
Right.
Here.
I mean, I would disagree. I would say, listen, just because actually committing a crime, being convicted, serving time, is probably what I would consider sort of a negative element of citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. That you've done everything, but in no way have you surrendered your citizenship. If mm-hmm. you were born a citizen,
exactly.
merely because you committed a crime doesn't mean that should be taken away at any point in time, right? Now, mm-hmm. the question becomes, if you commit an electoral fraud, should that be the issue?
Yeah,
right?
that's a little bit different.
But and the court and the law has been very difficult, has had a difficult time addressing economic issues, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the court does not like to, it's not a protected class. I mean, the court has been very reluctant to engage in this economic debate. We want capitalism, we want free, this sort of free market system, and they don't do anything to address it. It's not a review process that's sort of like race or gender or sexual orientation, because of the very touchy subject about it, as well as the myth that says we can all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, or it's my individualism, mm-hmm. and I don't want to commit to the community taxes or my individual taxes. I mean, I hear that argument, I go, well, are you driving on a public road? Do the police protect your house? Do you have a fire department there? Mm-hmm. Well, then it's a collective effort, mm-hmm. and I agree. We don't look out for the collective. Mm-hmm. I like the idea about the community having a greater voice, mm-hmm. but for the community to have a greater voice, it's actually got to care about the folks who are already alienated and marginalized.
Mm-hmm. You know, one place where we really could be making an impact right now, we're seeing this deficit reduction process, the super committee. They're coming back by November 23rd with a set of recommendations. And people ought to be talking to their senators and representative and telling them that they don't want things like our social insurance programs cut, that they do want fair taxes, which means taxing those who can afford it at a rate that will supply enough money to fund our government. These are the kinds of things that need to be said right now, and I would love to see people in the Occupy movement get more vocal around that set of issues, because you need to have some attainable objectives. And I see two things going on at once. On one hand, there's this upswelling of public concern around inequality. On the other hand, we have a process in our government that's moving towards massive cuts in government spending that's going to hurt poor people, working people, and the GOP portion of the Congress will not entertain any revenue enhancement or taxes increases at all, which is leaving us in a very bad situation. And it's a train wreck that's on its way, and people need to be speaking out about it. And I would love to see the Occupy movement speak out about this more over the next few weeks.
I'm going to have to take one more time to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Familiner, filling in for Reuben Stern, who's on vacation. Today on the show, we're examining grassroots social movements and why some flourish and others fizzle out. Joining us in the studio are Mark Heim, the director of Mid-Missouri Peaceworks, David Mitchell, an associate professor of law at MU, and Spencer Virostek, one of the activists with Occupy Como. Joining us on the phone is Gretchen Arnold, an assistant professor of sociology and women's studies at St. Louis University. And for you and our audience, how do you think the Occupy protests compare to other historical social movements? Give us a call at 573-882-8925, email us at intersection@kbia.org, or join our online chat. And that's, I guess, the other point I wanted to get to. We always ask this in the news, compared to what? We've talked a lot about Occupy, where you all would like to see it go, where it is at this point. But how does it fit into how grassroots social movements usually come along and how they usually process? Has this been a pretty common process, the way Occupy has happened as far as grassroots movements go, or is this?
It's upswelled much more quickly than we've usually seen movements get off the ground. Like in the anti-Vietnam War movement, the first protest took place in 1964. But the massive march on Washington, the first one, wasn't until 1967. And it took several years to build to that point. We've seen a much faster, trajectory of this spreading all across the country. On the other hand, we'll have to see if people can accept the notion that this takes years to accomplish goals. Because the reality is that virtually every social movement you think of, from the abolitionists to the women's rights and suffrage movement to civil rights movement, all the movements you can think of, labor movement, they all have taken decades to achieve goals. And certainly environmental and safe energy movements, more contemporary movements have been the same way. It's taken quite a while to get the traction, to build the base of support, to shift consciousness, to get elected officials elected who will be responsive, or get the ones who are in office to realize that they need to respond. It takes a while.
Assuming that there's a change in the economy, I think the question becomes, will the movement survive a change, an upswing in the economy, right? I think right now there is a confluence of events. In fact, people feel incredibly impacted and inspired to actually get out and protest. Well, when things start to get better, will people still have the same desire, the same goal, the same, if you will, desire to get out there and say, yes, we still need to change some things when things are better? And I think that's going to be the real test for this movement, right? I mean, if you're talking about other movements of being disenfranchised, civil rights, women and so forth in the war, those clearly had a goal that said, okay, this can't stop until this happens. Well, if things get better, does that mean we've accomplished something? Does that mean, in effect, something has been done and therefore people are now satisfied? I think it's easy to get complacent and satisfied when things are going well. I mean, how come Occupy didn't start under Clinton or Reagan, right? I mean, in effect, yeah, it had to be a confluence of events that created it. Well, when those events are gone, will it continue? Will it persist?
So you're not worried about whether it's going to get cold this winter. You're talking longer term than that. You're giving it a better chance than a few months. You're giving Occupy a longer term opportunity.
Well,
here.
Listen, when you hear on NPR or other news stories that food banks have to close before the end of the month because they've run out of food, when you hear that individuals are still being foreclosed upon, yeah, the economic situation is still dire. And it's still going to be dire for a whole lot of communities. I mean, to be honest, if I were, thinking about this movement, I would say, particularly as folks who've always been under the inequity groups that have always been at the bottom, to say, make sure that you folks who now joined or who are now much more visible, don't disappear when things get better for you, because there's always been economic inequality for us, right? And whether or not you're going to stay the long haul. And I think that's a fundamental question.
I find it interesting that two or three weeks into this, there was already talk about forgiving student loan debts. And it wasn't directly related to the occupation, but it was kind of interesting that, the timing happened as it did, wasn't it?
That's definitely a positive step that people are looking at that, but we need to do more, and we need to deal with the foreclosures issue. We need to deal with fair taxes, and we need to put the pressure on so that these things are moved forward, and we have to be targeted and focused. And I think that that's something that I'd like to see more of out of the Occupy movement as things move forward, is a really targeted and focused way of approaching these issues and taking them on in terms of the big picture, but also specific targets. And I think that what we're looking at right now with this super committee process and the deficit reduction, it's a very important issue that really is going to affect everything and everybody in our society.
And Gretchen, I hear you clearing your throat. What do you think? What do you think of the long-term chances for Occupy?
Well, I want to preface this by saying it's very hard to predict the future. But, you know, on the one hand, I don't see the economy getting better anytime soon. So that may and also, if the super committee, I don't know, whatever it does, may end up fueling the fire that has lit the Occupy Wall Street movement. But another thing I'm thinking of is, or another angle to look at it is, social movements can have a long-term impact if they are able to bring about institutional change. And so, you know, if Occupy Wall Street were to make the connection between inequality and the concentration of wealth and power on the one hand, and issues like or demand changes in government regulation of business and finance, changes in how we elect officials so that money doesn't play such a huge part in our electoral system. If they have the opportunity to make demands like that and get them, you know, get the changes made, then the movement can have a long-term impact no matter how long it lasts. I guess what I'm saying is it depends on at what level demands are actually made as to what the long-term repercussions of this movement are going to be.
Right. And
just one, if I could say, I mean, the forgiving student loan debt, right? I mean, you talk about this. This is the method of co-optation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that you can carve out segments of the population of the protest by saying, well, "We'll forgive some loan debts. We'll forgive some, you know, not so bad mortgages."
See, we're not so bad guys.
Exactly, right. And then you begin to sort of whittle away. Well, then who's left? Well, often the folks who are going to be left are the folks that have already been labeled as undeserving.
That's right.
And the folks that have already been at the bottom already. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the danger.
Well, thank you guys. We're out of time, but thank you very much. That's it for today's Intersection, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, filling in for Reuben Stern, who's on vacation. Today on the show, we examine grassroots social movements and why some flourish and others fizzle out. Our guests today were right here, Mark Higham, David Mitchell, Spencer Verostek, and Gretchen Arnold. We'd like to remind those of you that are enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch it live streaming video on our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Janet Saidi and Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Scratch that. It was Scott Pham today. Executive directors are Mark Dunn and Mike McKean, and I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Thanks again to our guests, and have a great week.